Nam Om Myoho Renge Kyo, Nam Om Myoho Renge Kyo, Nam Om Myoho Renge Kyo. Hi friends, how are you? I hope you're in good health and safe. Chapter 4. This chapter reminds me of resolve and discernment. Resolve and discernment. A constant refrain, certainly throughout Nietzschean doctrine, yeah? But it reminds me of a video I did some time ago called, what was it, Buddhist Burnout, I think is what I called it. We've all been there. We try and do things assiduously, consistently. We see benefits and that motivates us. And then at some point, we're not as motivated. And that's a pity because even though we continue to practice, we don't really put our all into it, do we? We kind of let it get kind of formal. We just act it out. And then it doesn't seem to be working. Well, of course, because we're not committed to it. But we don't see that at the time. And we have to remind ourselves, this is that era. That era where practice falls into habit and formalization and it ceases to motivate. And people even quit for some time. Only to, maybe it takes a month, maybe it takes a year, and then something happens, and then that little voice in the back of your mind go, you know, you should be chanting about this. And you almost, you hear that voice all the time, but for a long time, you just so, shut up, right? It's like a nagging. But then sooner or later, something happens to get your butt motivated and you get in front of your butsudan again and you start to chant again. And then, wow, it's all like new member benefit, we used to call it, yeah? All of a sudden, things start to change and your mind is altered and you're motivated again. That's whether you call it a seesaw or a roller coaster. We really, really have to work diligently to keep ourselves motivated. And ironically, it's that motivation that equals results. Chicken or egg problem, yeah? Well, that's samsara, my friends. That's what it is to live in the saha physical world. Samsara is always there to drag us to the cookie jar, to make us eat too much, to look to please the skandhas. To maybe it's okay if I get, if I drink a beer. Maybe it's okay if I enter samsaric attachment here. Yeah. Because, hey, look, it takes a lot of discipline to do this. I'm also reminded of oftentimes, and I've done videos upon this, on this subject of what is a monk. I have it on the website. I have it in videos. And I simplify it. Monk is a dedicated student. And I relate to that. I was dedicated in high school, or maybe I didn't get dedicated till I went to junior college or a four-year school or so on and so forth. There's something deeply satisfying and adventurous about being that kind of a student, yeah? But to be a Buddhist monk is to be that kind of a student all the time. And sometimes it's like learning to swim, right? At first you dog paddle and you learn how to float. And over time you get a little bit more confident, a little bit more courageous, and you try going above and below, and right, you develop your swimming skills to the place where you're satisfied. Not all of us are designed to be Olympian stars, right? But you don't have to be. Awakening our Buddha mind isn't that difficult. What is difficult is maintaining our momentum in Buddhism Why? To accomplish our bodhisattva mission, our bodhisattva, the very reason we're here in human form. Yeah, it takes effort. This is why I appreciate you being here and your practice. That's what I mean when I say that. So resolve and discernment. This whole chapter is kind of a parable, but it's not presented as a parable. And it also opens up the very subject at core of the Lotus Sutra here, is that the people who've been practicing with and listening or learning the last 40 years or so of Shakyamuni's teachings have fallen into this idea that Buddhahood is some ephemeral, unattainable thing, and that, breaking their attachments with the physical world and that idea of nirvana, that's all that can be accomplished. The problem with that is that you reach a point where, once you get there, what do you do now? See, it falls short. Because maintaining your Buddha mind, not easy, constantly has to be refreshed. Why? Why, you might ask. Once you reach it, aren't you done? For that moment, maintaining it is difficult because we live in the Saha world, surrounded constantly by the mind of samsara. If not constantly, and it is, the eight consciousnesses that we have. We have nine consciousnesses. Eight of them are samsara. That ninth consciousness, that Buddha, all-seeing, all-knowing, experiencing in the moment consciousness, it needs to be trained. It needs to be resuscitated from sleep. It needs to be made aware and constant, supervising the other eight. The other eight have a tremendous amount of influence, and they have this whole entire Saha world to use in order to get our attention. So yeah, it's a constant effort. But that effort becomes easier over time, just like the swimming thing I was saying earlier. Once you learn how to be a good swimmer, you're a good swimmer. It's not like you stay away from water for 10 years and you get back in the water and you forget, oh yeah, you don't have to start dog paddling. You remember, you may not be as physically adept as you used to be, but you know how to do it. It doesn't scare you. Right? So it gets easier over time, but it's a constant effort. So, with that effort, of course, that is what allows us to develop the breadth of knowledge, the understanding and insights that when we help others to discover their own path, we don't constantly imbue them with our personal stories, right? We're supposed to emulate Nichiren. How often did Nichiren talk about his personal life? You could say, yes, I was almost killed at Tatsunokuchi. I lived in Sado Island and somebody became my friend. You could say that's talking personally, but Nichiren always, if he touched on himself, it was because of the situation in relationship to the stories, the parables in the Lotus Sutra and other sutras, in the teachings of Zhiyi, Zhang'an, Tendai, right? Dengyo, Miaolo, Nagarjuna, Vasubandhu, all over, all the scholarship. And of course, Shakyamuni. Even teachings from outside of the scholarship of Buddhism that came from ancient Chinese lore depended on his audience, right? Depended on the person he was speaking to. Oh, what's that? Oh, yeah, skillful means. Nietzsche wants us to emulate him and his life. So 99.9% of the time when Nietzsche was speaking, answering a question, giving advice, he wasn't telling people, well, this is how I do it, right? I mean, right away, when you hear that kind of dialogue, it feels imposed upon you. No, Nietzsche was expert at pointing out, look what the, what this 3,000-year-old, what this 2,800, what this 2,000-year-old document says. Look at what this sutra says. Look at what Dengyo used to say about this kind of thing. You need inspiration. You want to know where to find inspiration. Nietzsche would pose himself as well-read, student, studied monk to basically be your librarian. That, look here, read this, read that. He was excellent at fitting scholarship from thousands of years all over the place in order to address a contemporary question. Also taking into account, is this a samurai I'm talking to? Is this an older woman I'm talking to? Is this a young woman who just lost her husband or brother? Is this, who am I talking to? What do they need to hear? Right? I don't need to talk to Shijo Kingo about menstruation. Duh. But Nietzsche could speak on these things, even though he himself was not a woman. Right? I put a whole book together on Nietzsche's letters, writings to women, because I think that deserves to be identified. He has a different voice. And yet, same sutras, right? Just presents the information so it relates to that particular person's difficulties. That's what you and I need to develop, yeah? At that time, the wisdom-destined Subhuti, Mahakatyayana, Mahakashyapa, and Mahamaggalyayana, hearing from the Buddha the unprecedented law and the prediction by the world-honored one of Shariputra's future destiny of perfect enlightenment, they were struck with wonder and ecstatic with joy. Why? Because so far, all those decades they'd been practicing was under the illusion that this false nirvana, this provisional nirvana teaching, was all that they could do. That was an error on their part. But Shakyamuni did what he had to do to keep people motivated, right? Don't quit. Don't quit. I've already talked about this, so I'm not going to repeat myself. Thereupon they rose from their seats and arranging their garments, humbly bearing their right shoulders, placing their right knees on the ground, with one mind folding their hands, bending their bodies in reverence, and gazing upon his honored face, addressed the Buddha, saying, we, heads of the monks, so these are like abbots, right? They're leaders amongst the monastic community. In years, moreover, worn out, consider that we have attained nirvana, the nirvana of the semblance and counterfeit dharma, right? And that there is nothing more we are able to undertake. So we do not press forward to seek after perfect enlightenment, because can't do it, right? That's what they've accepted in their minds. And they're lamenting here that, yeah, we've done all that. Now what? It's not like we can become Buddhas. Why did they make that decision, do you think? You think that's a cultural imperative? You think that that's just, you know, like, what do they call it? Groupthink. It's kind of sad that groupthink can be so powerful as to motivate every individual in the group or to stop them cold. The World Honored One for a long time has been teaching the law, and we, all the time, seated in our places, have become weary in our bodies and neglectful. Well, that's quite an admission. Only thinking of the empty, the formless, and the non-function, right? The basic tools of understanding, relinquishing attachment, and then thinking, well, that's nirvana. That's all we can do. No, you were supposed to learn something from that to take you further. But you all chose to make that the ultimate goal. You got lazy. And they're saying as much. We got neglectful. But in regard to the Bodhisattva laws, their supernatural displays, the purifying of Buddha lands, and the perfecting of all living beings, our hearts have not taken delight. It's too hard. And now right in front of us, you just dropped this on Shariputra. Boy, we missed it. We all along, we just missed it. For what reason? Because we have fancied that the World Honored One has caused us to escape the triple world and to obtain proof of nirvana. And besides, now we are so worn with age that in regard to perfect enlightenment for which the Buddha instructs bodhisattvas, we have not conceived a single fond thought of joy. What? Now we, in the presence of the Buddha, hearing that Sravakas are predicted to attain perfect enlightenment, are extremely glad in our minds and have obtained that which we have never experienced before. Oh, this is possible. Yeah. What have you been doing? Right? I'm telling you, this Lotus Sutra was quite a revolution. It didn't need to be, but it needed to be. You know what I mean? Shakyamuni observed that, yeah, I need to put my foot down, so to speak, right? You guys forgot what all of this was about. What have you been doing? Unexpectedly, we suddenly and unexpectedly hear this rare law. Oh, we can awaken our Buddha-ness ourselves? Yeah, profoundly do we congratulate ourselves on having acquired so great a good gain, an inestimable jewel, without seeking it. In other words, obviously, the work we've done was good enough to get us here, because we're now hearing it. So good on us, but my bad, we failed to continue. We failed to understand that this was available. Seems a little disingenuous to congratulate themselves at the moment, but let's go on. World Honored One, now let us have the pleasure of speaking in a parable to make plain this meaning, what we're saying. So I have an annotation here. This is the possible manifestation of the thought that there is an apparent paradigm shift in the definition of a bodhisattva from the semblance dharma goals to this goal, this new goal of Buddhahood in this lifetime. This would be the justification for a fourth vehicle addition to the three vehicles and accepted as the one Buddha vehicle. There's some discussion about that in different academic circles. Is the three vehicles of Sarvata, Sarvaka, Pratyekabuddha, and Bodhisattva, that third Bodhisattva, is that the same as the Bodhisattva we're now discussing in the Lotus? And if it was rhetorically the same, was it not different in its understanding of the ultimate goal? Because he does identify three lower vehicles, lesser vehicles, including Bodhisattva, looking to attain Buddhahood, but perhaps practiced, ununderstood as not in this lifetime. That may be the crux of the difference, which is a little irritating when you and I know that that was the point all along. but cultural paradigms, traditions, habits, they're hard to break. All right. So here goes Subhuti speaking along with the other head monks. It is like a man who in his youth leaves his father and runs away. For long he dwells in some other country for 10, 20, or 50 years. Right? The older he grows, the more needy he becomes, not having the support of family or father in this case, yeah. Roaming about in all directions to seek clothing and food, he gradually wanders along till he unexpectedly approaches his native country. Now, I guess this is a simile for the way these monks have behaved. They've had this great teacher, Father Shakyamuni, and they've been out there practicing their way to nirvana, whatever they thought that was. And they deviated from Shakyamuni's teaching. Maybe not literally in the sense that they were following different actual teachings, but in their minds, they wandered to their own interpretation of the teachings, right? From the first, the father searched for his son, but in vain, and meanwhile settled in a certain city. His home became very rich, his goods and treasures incalculable, gold, silver, lapis lazuli, coral, amber, crystal, and other gems, so that his granaries and treasuries overflow. He has many youths and slaves, retainers and attendants, and numberless elephants, horses, carriages, animals, everything that represents wealth and power, right? And he has traders and customers. He's the Amazon of ancient India, yeah? At this time, the poor son, wandering through village after village and passing through countries and cities, at last reaches the city where his father has settled, but he doesn't know it. The father has always been thinking of his son, and though he has parted from him in over 50 years, he has never spoken of the matter to anyone. He's kept private, only pondering it himself and cherishing regret in his heart as he reflects to himself, old and worn, I own much wealth, gold, silver, and jewels, granaries, and treasuries overflowing, but I have no son. So this was his only son. Someday my end will come and my wealth will be scattered and lost, for there is no one to whom I can leave it. Thus does he earnestly, whenever he thinks of his son, repeat this reflection. If I could only get back my son and commit my wealth to him, how contented and happy should I be, with never any more anxiety. How could I retrieve the goal of Buddhahood in my lifetime? How could I want for anything else? That's really what that's saying, yeah? But it's a parable. World-honored one, meanwhile, the poor son, hired for wages here and there, unexpectedly arrives at his father's house. Standing by the gate, he sees from afar his father seated on the lion couch, his feet on a jeweled footstool, revered and surrounded by Brahmins, Kshatriyas, and citizens, and with strings of jewel worth thousands and myriads adorning his body. Attendants and young slave with white fly whisks wait on him right and left. He is covered by a precious canopy from which hang streamers of flowers. Perfume is sprinkled on the earth. All kinds of famous flowers are scattered around and precious things are placed in rows. Some he accepts, others he rejects. Such is his glory and the honor of his dignity. The poor son, seeing his father possessed of such great power, was seized with fear, regretting that he had come to this place, and secretly reflected thus, this must be a king or someone of royal rank. He doesn't know it's his father. It is no place for me to obtain anything for the hire of my labor, right? I had better go to some poor hamlet where there is a place to hire out my labor, and food and clothing are easier to get. If I tarry here long, I may suffer oppression and forced labor. Right? I'm in a power center here. I'm a meager, you know, slave, really. I hire myself for odd jobs. I could get into trouble here. They might even see me as a danger to this king or important person. Could you imagine being a monk in a huge assembly, meeting Shakyamuni Buddha, and feeling this way? That's a really tough lack of confidence, right? Not much dignity in there. Having reflected thus, he hastily runs away. Meanwhile, the rich elder on his lion seat has recognized his son at first sight. Wait a minute, that's my son. And with great joy in his mind has thus reflected, now I have the one to whom my treasures of wealth are to be made over. Always have I been thinking of this, my son, with no means of seeing him, but suddenly he himself has come, and my longing is satisfied. Though worn with years, I still yearn for him. So instantly, he dispatches his attendants to rush after him and fetch him. Go get him. Go get that man. Thereupon, the messengers hasten forth to seize him. The poor son, surprised and scared, loudly cries his complaint. I have committed no offense against you. Why should I be arrested? He's scared. The messengers all the more hasten to lay hold of him and compel him to go back. Thereupon, the poor son thinks to himself that though he is innocent, yet he will be imprisoned, and that will certainly mean his death, so that he is all the more terrified. He faints away and falls on the ground. Oh, my goodness. The father, seeing his son from afar, what's going on? Gives the messengers his word. There's no need for this man. Do not fetch him by force. Sprinkle cold water on his face to restore him to consciousness, and do not speak to him any further. Let him go. For what reason? The father, knowing that his son's disposition is inferior, knowing that his own lordly position has caused distress to his son, yet profoundly assured that he is his son, tactfully says nothing to others that this is his son. A messenger says to the son, I now set you free. Go wherever you will. The poor son is delighted, thus obtaining the unexpected. He rises from the ground and goes to a poor hamlet in search of food and clothing. I'm going to pause there. It's an interesting story, made all the more interesting because you understand that these are the elder monks explaining themselves to Shakyamuni. There's a lot of very sad admissions in this story, aren't there? And I left my highlighter open overnight. Duh. Let's see if I can rescue it from death. Thank you for listening. It's an interesting chapter, an interesting view on how we can get, what did I title that video? Burned out. We need to stay motivated. And we need to know with each daimoku that we are accomplishing this great task. So I implore upon you. You know, watch that video I did on presence at the Butsudan. Give yourself a mental preparation every time you go ahead. Make it a ritual, but a ritual that's meaningful. See yourself at this very assembly, right? And in a few moments, we're going to be in this assembly, floating in the air. We're not there yet. Coming. All right, my friends, enjoy your practice. Savor it. Really, with that kind of ichinin, that volition, that desire, that commitment, that resolve, you will succeed. There's no other choice. But you have to want to succeed. That's as old as the hills, yeah? All right, I'm going to let you go. Please take care of your health. Keep your practice strong. And I'll see you in the next one. All right. Bye for now.